I would like to bring up our first speaker, Dr. Otto Strock, and my five-year-old son. I practiced my introduction on him. He says it's a little weird, so I apologize ahead of time, but my family, my mother's family, is Dutch, which is maybe where this came from. But I was wondering who else, besides myself, and this is a recent bit of knowledge, who else knows that before the Dutch, carrots were not orange? This is true. Yes, I got one, two, three. Seriously, it is the Dutch. So our concept of the common vegetable that we all use every day, the carrot, we completely take for granted. But it was the Dutch that made it orange. Rumor has it in honor of William of Orange. And I think that's a good metaphor for our first speaker. I would say that Dr. Strock has really, in a similar way, our understanding of Minnesota groundwater, our understanding of modeling, and how we approach groundwater in Minnesota, many of us take for granted how we think about it and how we approach it. And that was because of much of the work that Dr. Strock has done. And so I'm very happy that you are here today and that you are kicking off our conference on groundwater sustainability. Thank you. I warned you it was going to be weird, but no less sincere.
Not sure whether that's the carrot or the stick. No, I did not know that. I thought I knew everything there was to know about Holland, but I didn't know that. Okay, so I learned something new about Holland. Okay, so perhaps some of you know that I have a totally undeserved reputation for liking mathematics. So I'm positive that you all look forward to a talk, initial talk today, with heavy mathematics. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to disappoint. There's not going to be mathematics. If you like it, you have to come to my classes. But today, it's not. In fact, there's really not much new. I'm going to talk about groundwater sustainability, mostly looking from the viewpoint of agriculture. And what I'm going to show you is almost exclusively taken from existing literature. So a lot of it, not everything, but a lot of it is just data collection. Now, I've been aware of problems about sustainability for a number of years at the Modflow More conferences. Every time there's a lot of discussion about it. But when I started preparing this talk, which I gave before for the department at the university, I had no idea it was that bad. So we have some serious problems. So I'm going to divide it up into two parts. The first part is depletion and the effect on farms, and mostly from the idea that farms get their water from the aquifer, but the aquifer is really the mechanism to get it through the farm. If you didn't have aquifers, then we'd have to pump all the water through the farms, it would be really a problem. And then the second part is, again, mostly think of agriculture, where we cannot make huge models and have to look at farms and things individually. Is there a simple way to be able to assess groundwater and groundwater problems without building huge models?
Can you turn on that button?
Oh, okay. Technology. Thank you.
Okay.
Does it work?
It will.
Okay, so you haven't heard anything yet. It wasn't that important anyway. I just told you that there won't be any math. That's the short of it. So here is a slide I got from USGS. And I showed it because it puts into perspective the difference between agricultural use and other use. So in the western states particularly, we have not a lot of water. That green curve on the right diagram shows you western states agricultural water use compared to the rest of the U.S., but you do see in the rest of the U.S. it's climbing, and it's climbing because of the practices in agriculture that we're changing, and we are using more water because of the way we do agriculture. And you see industry and domestic use is much less. So this is a picture of the Ogallala Aquifer, High Plains Aquifer, which I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to show you a few things of what happened. This picture is just land surface elevation, so I put it in just mostly to show you what it looks like. You probably already know, but it's that is what it is. And I've taken a paper by Leonard Conikow from the USGS, and he is looking at, I don't have anything, this was a study that went all the way to 2008. The pictures changed a little, but the trend is quite clear. So 1,000 cubic kilometers of depletion from 1900 to 2008. Now, a kilometer is a big thing. It's not quite a mile, but it's then that order. And a cubic kilometer, it's big. So 1,000 cubic kilometers. It's incredible. The point is that on average, between 1900 and 2008, it was 9.2 cubic kilometers. But if you look after the year 2000, it's 25 cubic kilometers. So you see there's a dramatic increase. So now the question is, what does it do, or what does all of that do? And this is a picture from the same paper by Leonard Conikow about groundwater depletion in cubic kilometers, and these various colors over the United States show you depletion. The blue, the two on the left over there. No, I can show you like this here. So here, that is actually increase. But all the rest is decrease, and the red is the worst. I mean, you can see here these areas. Here's the High Plains Aquifer. It's pretty serious because, you know, that's a large amount of depletion. In terms of water level change, again, having the different colors show what's happening, this is really quite scary. You see there's 150 feet of water level change in some areas, but 50 to 100 is quite a bit, of course. One of my former students, Dave Stewart, who teaches at Kansas State, is facing problems in the southern half of the states where agriculture is almost impossible. This is just an example of a USGS well in Cook County, Georgia, that shows you the general trend. It goes from 165 feet below ground surface and goes 20 feet down over this period from 67 to 2002. So here, again, in feet, now I hate people who produce tables on conferences, and here it is. I enlarged it and I broke it up, but the numbers are so important I couldn't resist showing them. You see here, now each of these numbers, right, is a decrease in water level elevation in feet for the various states. But the point is that it's cumulative, right? So if you see the number in New Mexico, minus 14.5 in 2000, then you have to add in 2002 another 14.5. So that is the sum of the two. So it adds up, and that's how you got in that picture to decreases in level of 150 feet. You see it's quite dramatic. Kansas, I already mentioned. Colorado, the High Plains Aquifer, Texas, it's dramatic. The change in the funny thing is there's not that much change in terms of area. The green is no change. The blue is added and the red is lost. So you don't see something dramatic here, but it gives you an idea, first of all, where it happens. It's mostly in the West, and that it's really not increasing all that much in terms of area. In terms of quantities, of course, a different story. So here are the seven states with the highest areas for irrigation. So California is leading, Nebraska, Texas, Arkansas, Idaho, Kansas, Colorado, and we are not even mentioned. So this is I don't know whether you have the National Geographic, but it's quite interesting if you look at the 2014 edition and the website When the Snows Fail. This is, of course, you're reading about Governor Brown in California taking all kinds of measures and California being in dire need of water. Well, this preceded that, and this explains what's happening. So this is snowpack change, 1955 to 2014, and all of the blue is where the snowpack increases, and there's just a tiny little bit, but all the other stuff is where the snowpack decreases. Now, this is not just, sometimes you get the impression when you need articles that this is just the last few years, but this is really over a fairly long period. And so most of it is decreasing, which is the reason why the use from reservoirs, which is shown here. So the blue is the reservoirs, and their size, the size of those blue circles, that reflects what the reservoir does when it's full, and they're not full at the moment. And the dark colors, and you see it's mostly Southern California, but you see Arizona, and that's where the water use occurs. So what's happening now, of course, is that people are resorting to using groundwater, and that means, of course, that water levels go down even farther. So this is Shasta Lake. It's one of those big blue circles. That's 65% below the historic average. This is Lake Mead. That's also not too far from that area I just showed. That's 38% full. And I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, if you look at that journal, the reduction is significant. So there's reduction in surface water sources. Snowfall reservoirs are going down. And the pumping of groundwater increases because the practice, as I mentioned before, the practices we are using will demand more water. And sometimes there are things that you might not immediately realize, but if you use the modern practices where the soil is essentially dead, there is no, you know, it's just you use artificial means to get the crops to grow, well, that soil doesn't retain the water as well, so it goes through more quickly. We have a lot of crops that are desert crops that require a lot of water. So we increase in our practices more and more use of water, but the amount that comes into the system is not increasing. So that's the basic problem. We get more people, we get different practices, we use more and more water, but nature doesn't oblige by giving us more coming in. So here's an example. So you, in California, you start pumping more groundwater, and the result is subsidence of 30 feet in some places. So in California and also in Oregon, you get a credit as a farmer if you use groundwater instead of surface water. Okay, so I'm giving you an example, Idaho. I've done some consulting, and I have friends in Idaho, and there are some things that I think will be with us for a while. One of the problems is that water rights in most of the western states are granted on the basis of when the farm was started. Right. So it's been how many years ago you got your right. And so in Idaho, if you happen to be on a farm that has the oldest water right, you can irrigate and use as much as you want. There's absolutely no restriction. And the next person down the line will be able to use whatever is left. And so there's no incentive. You see a lot of irrigation high above the ground with lots of losses in evaporation. And there's really no incentive to do anything about it. Irrigation goes over during the day. I talked to somebody there and said, you know, how about, you know, giving farmers a credit if they irrigate by night? And he said, boy, that's a great idea. We should consider that. Okay, so this is an example here. This is in Idaho. That is, I don't know who, some of you might know Bill Nelson. He's an old, rather famous person in groundwater. He's published a lot of papers in the past. He's still active. He's in his 80s. And his family owns land there. And you see what happens when you start irrigating. You see clearly difference in color here. And you see this is nice. They use, I don't know if you can see it, but these wheels roll over the field and it's irrigation relatively low to the ground. But, you know, if you don't irrigate, and this is grass, by the way, this is grass. And the grass in Idaho is put into large square bales. And the bales are then shipped to China and made into horse nuts. Not all of it, but that happens. It's quite simple. I could not believe it. They told me that. We ship them to China, the hay bales, they go into horse nuts, and then they're sold in England. Anyway, so the hay in Idaho is very high quality. It's extremely good hay. I farm hay, so I know about it. I'm very jealous when I go to Idaho and I look at that hay. I smell it. You know, this is dryland farming. So that is what they used to do. This Bill Nelson, when his family got there and they started farming, it was all dryland farming. So every 3 years you have a crop. And you plow the topsoil over to retain the moisture. And then every 3 years you can actually, sometimes 2 years if it's a really good year. So it's possible, and they do that here, but it is not very productive. So there are questions. You know, what can we do about reducing water use? Are there ways we can make better use of what we have? And one of the obvious things is to modify irrigation practice. So one of the things I mentioned already is how about irrigating at night? This is especially valid in warm areas, but it's... And only irrigate when you have to. And maybe you don't plant pistachio nuts in California. I mean, they're very use a lot of water, and there might be other things that would be a little better to do there. And so these Western water laws encourage that you just do it. They told me they switch on the pump and they irrigate, period. You don't have to do that. Irrigate at night and do not use. So don't irrigate a lot and then use drains to control the groundwater level. That's a terrible waste. Modify the method of irrigation. Put the sprinklers low. A farmer needs, if he wants to do that, if he wants to change his system or put in a new system, you're talking $60,000 for a moderate-sized field. It's difficult. And this is an idea that I would like to just pass by you. No mathematics. Subsurface irrigation. And this is what I want to do at my farm. That's my farm. And I do hay in the summers. And the problem is this was, you can't really see that because this is a fairly good supply of water normally, but it's really, there is, this was a dry year, and there was not as much crop as you would want. And in those lower areas, you see these low-lying areas here, for example, there's, the grass was twice as long as a little higher up. So I thought, well, one of the things I could do is this. So we have a lot of rainstorms, they're very intense. And so the water gets collected, if you don't collect it, it just runs off. But we have a lot of erosion control dams that hold the water, and then, there's an overflow, and it's just meant to reduce erosion. What I'm going to do this summer is build a dam and hold the water, and then use a trencher, the same kind of trencher you use to put electric lines in. It's about this wide, and you can go pretty fast in land. You know, I can go pretty quickly by narrow drains, and run those to the bottom of this pond, so that when the water comes into the pond, you build the dam afterwards, and then when the water comes into the pond, then the drains fill and will keep the soil moist. So that would save a lot of water. First of all, you don't lose the runoff, you use it, and secondly, you don't need any power. Farmers can do this. They all have these kinds of things. They have tractors and backhoes and bulldozers. That's why I farm. When I chose civil engineering, I chose it because then I got to drive bulldozers. And that didn't pan out. I ended up behind the computer. So now I have a bulldozer. So I can do this. But, it's something that I think has real potential. You have to have some difference in elevation, but not a whole lot. I mean, the drains will fill, and they will carry the water quite far, and I think it could be quite efficient. I called the DNR in Wisconsin, because they support farmers who build dams, right? So I called them up and I said, well, it's great. They can help me. And they said, I told them where I wanted to put the dam. And they said, okay, then this is where you put the overflow. I said, overflow? No. It goes into the soil. Overflow are my drains. It goes into the ground. You can't support that. You can only support it if you have an overflow because it is to control erosion. I explained it to them and they said, great, but we can't do it. So I'm saying that because some of the ideas we have to adjust, and it's going to take time. So the advantage is it's cheap. The farmer can run his own equipment. He doesn't have to pay $60,000 for this irrigation system. You don't need valves. You use your surface runoff, and there's no power needed, even with very minimal difference in elevation, and you use excessive runoff. And I know you can never convince people without proving it, so I'm going to do it, make photos of difference of crop sizes and so on. Convince them. Okay, so, but there's commercial subsurface irrigation as well. I got this from UC Davis, and it's a field where they do subsurface irrigation. And the next two images I really like. This is a subsurface irrigation field, and this is the machine. Now, I know what this sort of thing would cost. I didn't check it out, but it couldn't be much more than, say, $10,000-$15,000 to buy this. So it sits behind a tractor on a three-point hitch, and it has these rollers. I think there are another two. And it puts very thin perforated tubing, into the ground, and you just drive your tractor. Of course, he plowed it first. Drive your tractor through, and it drops the irrigation tube, and you just hook it up to some pump, and you have your subsurface irrigation. This actually turns out to be quite profitable in California, so I hope they'll keep doing that more and more. Okay, so now the next step is especially again about these, this is focusing again about agriculture, remote areas where we don't have models, we can't use them. So then the question is, how can we use models to make an assessment? Now this is a typical model of what we have faced here within the Twin Cities. You have all this, these leaky layers. I'm pretending I'm a geologist here, so the scales are greatly exaggerated vertically. Kelton has taught me over about a 40-year period how to read these things. I'm learning, so I've done this all by myself. And so you have this really complicated system. And so now this is what we do when we have models, right? We need a lot of data, hydraulic conductivity, aquifer configuration, storativity, infiltration. I put the X where we are reasonably sure what we have, boundary conditions and boundary locations, and then typically we have to estimate these parameters. Now, this is an old talk, but not quite just the next slide. So this is what it ends up with, right? You have this model, and it has every node has a different hydraulic conductivity. So phenomenal model, and you get beautiful pictures, and it's reality. But if you do a very simple, Randall Barnes and I did a very simple model of a cluster of inhomogeneities in a field of uniform flow. The green points are measurements, just to see how well do you do. If you have perfect knowledge of the heads at all these points, and you know the uniform flow field, which in principle we don't know, and you start doing parameter estimation, you know, using MATLAB, how good is that? Well, this is Randall did the simulation, so, oops, I hit the wrong button here. So the upper picture is the actual, and the lower one is the fit after you do parameter estimation, and it looks pretty good. And these are the data. I think they speak for themselves. So it turns out this is, if you really want to get it right, you have to have different directions of flow. But even then, it is not really all that good. So there was at the last 2 years ago, the Modflow Moore conference, was a discussion, an open discussion, led by Mary Hill, who is quite well known about parameter estimation. And the discussion was, how reliable are our groundwater models? And Mary, and I'm quoting, said, not quite as reliable as weather forecast. She said, according to her, weather forecast is a lot more reliable, and the reason is, of course it's not that great, but it is, on average, it's not so bad. Actually, if you objectively take all the predictions, if they say tomorrow 60% chance of rain, and you go over a long enough period, actually, it's not so bad. It works reasonably well for 2 or 3 days, but beyond that, it's science fiction. So, so she said, well, you know, the problem is that we do not check our models enough. Right? We should build a model and then check it, run it, and check it, measure, check it, update it. And we don't do quite enough of that, so that's one of the reasons. But we have to recognize there's these models. So if you have a model that's been used, especially if it's in a metropolitan area, we have much more data for over a long period of time, and you keep adjusting the model, it eventually will get better. But you need large amount of data. It is expensive to create. The predictions are rarely tested, and much, much, much data, and it's hard to say what the influence of the data are. So if you have one of these farms, or a farm, or you're looking at southern Kansas or Idaho, the resources simply are not there to create something like that. So how do you assess what's going on? And I'm a great fan of Einstein. I think this is a fantastic quote. A model should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. He said, no simpler. And that's true. So I'm going to talk about two examples of simple models. And it's aimed at sustainable groundwater use for farms. And the other example is reduction of saltwater intrusion, because that's another really important thing that we can, our coastal aquifers are in danger as well. Florida, California, East Coast, West Coast. So if we only look at, if we look at sustainability, and possibly also a little bit of contamination because of nutrients that we put in the ground,
then the problem becomes simpler if we step away from trying to solve this fantastic problem with all the details and try to and ask ourselves, what really do we need to focus on? And so I'm becoming more and more a fan of vertically integrated flow models, where instead of looking at all these layers and strata and so on, you say, well, I'm only really interested in the total. How much do I lose? You know, if I have this area, how much is lost over the boundaries? How much comes in? And that is a lot more precise. So if you think of a very simple, here are the equations. I'm sorry. I couldn't help it. So this is a layer, and it has a thickness A. This capital QX is the total discharge, integrated. But the beauty is it's an equation that can be expressed in terms of average heads and saturated thickness, and you can formulate a problem like that rather well. And I'm going to show my farm as an example of how you could try to manage resources with a very simple, very quick model without all the bells and whistles that a farmer like me could afford. So that's the boundary, and I'm going to look at this, and I have infiltration, and I have extraction. I don't have any wells, but I could put them in. So you put the boundary in and areas of infiltration. Now, this boundary is just the boundary of a farm. Could be a boundary of a collection of farms, a small township, some area where you're interested in what's happening to the water use. So these infiltration areas in black, they're a little different because they're trees and it's different topsoil. And so you put wells in and a pond, and you compute the flow over the boundary of that thing, vertically integrated in total. There's another example is, this is a, you know, a similar area. You do the same thing. You put all the infiltration in and all the wells, and then you look at integrated. So we forget about this detail. We look at integrated. What is the total? And you see, we have this complex system. There's leakage through these leaky layers. Right? But if you integrate it vertically, if you look at the total, it goes out of one aquifer and goes into the other. So it doesn't affect the water balance. The only thing that matters is how much comes in. That the sum is leaking to a lower layer, it doesn't matter where the well is. If there's a well and it pumps a discharge, well, it doesn't matter where it is. It pumps that discharge. So integrated, the problem becomes a lot simpler. So this is a paper that I wrote with one of my students that allows us to do this, and where you can compare how much you lose if you do this vertical integration. Now, as an example, this is a circular infiltration area. Without knowing anything about the hydraulic conductivity, this is very simple. You can compute how much goes over the boundary. You infiltrate a certain amount. Farmer knows how much he infiltrates. That goes over the boundary. That's clear. You don't need any more detail. So that is the idea. So this is that an example of that kind of a model, where on the left you have this complicated figure, but on the right we just add infiltration areas and wells, and we estimate in total what goes over the boundaries where, and whether we're losing or gaining, and that kind of a model, because it needs less data. It's cruder, it's not as precise, but it's based on mass Dallons and vertically integrated flow, and it is not affected by vertical placements. So it's important where the well is in plan, but not in which aquifer. So anyway, we have to look at this kind of simplification to make assessments. Basically, just in minus out is loss. And existing features don't really matter because you're really only interested in what happens with your irrigation practices. That some of it goes to a river and some to a lake is really not that critical. So anyway, that is basically the idea. How am I doing for time? Am I okay? Okay, there's one more example I want to show you. That's an example of how vertical integrated models, simple models, can give a lot of insight. So one of the problems that we are facing worldwide, actually, is that all aquifers near the sea, when you're pumping, and of course we do that, we need to pump. Australia is another example where this is really critical. You tend to get this tongue. So this is salt water, right? All the white here is salt water. The blue is fresh groundwater. So it's flowing over the salt water. The salt water doesn't really move much because we're not pumping in it. And on average, it's pretty much at rest. So we have what we call an interface. In reality, that's a little bit more vague, but there are sharp interfaces exist as well. And what we are really interested in is this tip here. So there's a tip in that tongue. And when we pump, the tip moves out. So I did this analysis. This is a paper that I just submitted. And you see here the red line and the blue line are differences between taking into account that we have a stratified aquifer with different hydraulic conductivity. So these layers have different properties. And the blue is one where we have much more hydraulic conductivity at the bottom located than above. So what happens is, and this is totally, really counterintuitive, I ask people just for fun, you know, if you have an aquifer and you make the bottom, and there's salt water, sea, right, that wants to intrude, and you increase the hydraulic conductivity at the bottom, so far everybody has said, okay, this salt water moves in. And it's the opposite, it moves out. Because it makes it, the freshwater is the one that's flowing, and it makes it much easier for the freshwater to flow to the sea, and it pushes this the interface out. And it's dramatic. You can actually get the saltwater interfaced almost all the way to the coast. So I have this idea of possibly increasing the hydraulic conductivity at the bottom with frac sand, and we make good use of it, because we could do that even in a permeable aquifer, because we could make the grain size uniform, which would make it very permeable. So anyway, that is the picture here of, this is the third formula. So the total thickness, so we have the total thickness of this aquifer. Oh, this is really, I find it intriguing. So the total thickness is the sum of the two thicknesses. Oh, we can deal with it, right? And the total transmissivity is the sum of two transmissivities. We can deal with that too. So I want to now know where the tip is of the saltwater tongue. That gray mass is seawater, the blue is fresh groundwater. And you see in the picture that big arrow, that is increase in flow simply by trying to increase the hydraulic conductivity. And the formula for the ratio of the location of the tip with an increased, if I distribute the hydraulic conductivity, make it more permeable at the bottom as opposed to uniform, but the same total transmissivity, is that formula. So if I make the transmissivity of layer one almost the same as the total, so I put all the transmissivity at the bottom, then it is 1 minus 1 plus, and if I make that layer also very thin, it goes to 0. So you push the interface out to the coast. So that is, and this is an example, this is just two layers, where I do that, and it's not even so dramatic, and you see that it really moves out. So it's one of the things we have to, so this is an example, so I'm proposing to start thinking about how we can eliminate problems with saltwater intrusion, eliminate problems caused by loss of by evaporation, try to find irrigation methods that are more appropriate, and try to create very simple models so that the farmer can assess rather quickly, I'm losing water and it's mostly going there, so that neighbor is getting water but I'm drawing it from him, so my nutrients go that way. So that is, those are measures I'm proposing. This is an example. One of my students, Bonnie, asked, did this. This is Florida. And I show this because this here, this is a canal. These are canals. This is a plan view of Florida. This is the coast. And these levels are heads above sea level, is of course zero. And the red line here is the location of the interface. What they do in Florida is they put canals, so where my arrow is, these are canals. And in the dry period, they feed the canals with water, and it pushes, as you can see in the picture, it pushes the interface out. There's a big well right here. Here are the canals. And so what they're doing is putting in really good groundwater to keep the interface out. It would be ideal if we could do that mechanically without having to waste a lot of water in that way. Okay, anyway, that is all I had. So thank you very much for putting up with me so long. Are there questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm just going to use this one. We have some time for some questions, and I suspect that there are some good ones. And we have some microphones. Nobody's allowed to open their mouths unless we have a microphone. And the reason for that is because we do want to capture your questions, and we're recording this. So I believe Kelton has a question.
For that last example, could you have the tongue move back toward the sea coast line if you made the saltwater tongue more salty?
Ah, that is a good question. That's good, very good question. So the basic principle of this interface is that there is a difference in weight between the saltwater and freshwater. And if I raise the head in the freshwater by 1 meter, for say on our east coast or west coast, it moves down about 50 meters. That is because the ratio between the density of the freshwater over the difference is about 50. So if I make that difference smaller, it moves farther. So I have to do this is again counterintuitive. I have to make the densities closer. It's amazing how I've been in love with groundwater for 45 years or so. And it is amazing. One of the things I like so much about it is always counterintuitive. I can always catch my students. I can always ask them a question that has an obvious answer. Say, you're wrong.
I have a mic.
Very good.
On the vertically integrated simple model, it seems that you're implying that estimating infiltration is an easy thing, and I always thought it was a hard thing.
That's a good point. Maybe. However, everything is relative, right? I already said I like Einstein. Everything's relative. So relative to what we know about hydraulic conductivity, infiltration is the easy one. And the big unknown is the hydraulic conductivity. So if I ask you how close can you estimate infiltration, you're talking about factor 2 or 3 or 4. You ask somebody how well do you know the hydraulic conductivity. Oh, we got it pretty well nailed down. It's within 2 orders of magnitude. We're pretty sure. And since the ratio of the two affects water levels, I tend to like infiltration. But of course, another thing, it's a very good point, but farmers will have some idea. They know what they pump and they should be able to estimate evaporation and plant use, so I'd assume, sort of. But yeah, I mean, it's a good point. It's the basic point. That's what Mary Hill said. We lack the data. That's our problem, being in groundwater.
I'm looking around. I don't have my glasses on, so hands up really high if there's Gil, and then we have one question here too.
This has nothing to do with the actual presentation, except several of your slides. At the bottom of the slide, there was some bizarre figure. And I'm wondering if that is a student that didn't quite make it, and they're doing a scarecrow type routine there for you or something. So what was that?
You have to take that up with the president of the University of Minnesota. That's the University of Minnesota logo that we have to put down at the bottom of each slide. Oh. I don't know what that is. So what is it? Yeah. Oh. On my farm?
That pink.
I see. Good question. Okay. Open question. What is it? You all know what it is. It's not a student. Wrong. What is it? Oh, Kelton. Yes, brilliant. Top of an umbrella. Yeah, it is. That's a good point. I should have. I tried to make it realistic.
Do we still have another question?
Yes, I'm Josh Uran from Drolco Well Company. And I found your damming and putting the water underneath the ground is very interesting. In my backyard, I have vegetables, flowers on a third of an acre. So I trim back the trees, allow 6 hours of sunlight in. And I have a slope that I tear down 5 levels for the groundwater to slowly soak into the gardens as it runs down towards my front yard. And I would like to put up more of a damming system to allow some of this water to flow through into the ground like you're describing. So when I see this tractor out on the field, I'd like to know how deep they're planting those thin rows that percolate the water under planting.
Not very deep.
But are they going to till over that again, leaving those lines in? So how deep are those lines in the ground?
I don't know. But it depends. There are drain spacing formulas. The level you have to put the drains depends on how close they are.
Yes.
And it's an old system, and we have these formulas. And so I assume that it will not be the same everywhere.
Right.
Depends on the soil type, the spacing. But I would imagine that they would almost have to make sure, even though they can control where the wheels of the tractor go, to make sure that it is deep enough. But soil spreads, the stress is, spreading very quickly.
Yep.
So it doesn't have to be all that deep.
Okay. Because I'd like to can and freeze my vegetables and flowers to bring in the good bugs, and everything's organic. I have six compost piles to, deliver everything back to the ground and keep that garden alive organically.
Exactly. So that is what we are doing here, too. That's why I farm.
Yep.
Because there's no way to have a farm and not have it, organic. It's all...
Right. No pesticides, nothing. Just manual.
Yeah. Well, manual with machine. I'm using machines to harvest, but I don't make the bales by hand.
No.
We need
thank you for your time.
not for the bales. But you need a bulldozer. That's a good point.
Do we have any other... Oh, a question here? Thank you.
This is not a mathematical question.
I would have expected one from you.
I was intrigued by your increasing hydraulic conductivity in your saltwater intrusion problem. Are you suggesting that hydraulic fracking would be in a horizontal math? In other words, just like the oil field?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I would really love to do is use that technology. And then the only problem is we have an expert in fracking at the department, at the Tournai. And he told me that, it's unlikely that you get a lot more permeable sand, but the key is to make it uniform in grain size, which incredibly... that makes it much more permeable. So I think it's doable because the technology, these guys say only 30 feet, what are you talking about? 40 feet down, they go kilometer,
Do we have, another question? And then over to you.
Say, Otto. Otto, I have a question for you on your diagram for what you're doing on your farm.
Ah, there you are.
Yeah. Okay. You're going to create an area where you're going to dam up water and then release it through the little drain lines that you have in your field.
Correct.
What are you going to do to keep the siltation from the bottom of your pond from plugging up those lines?
Well, the pond is it's accessible, so I would have to inspect it and see how well it goes. And it's an experimental thing, so I'm going to build it and monitor because it is it's not that deep. But I agree. I mean, there are problems. But I think that the holes in those drains are fairly large. The drains themselves may be plugging up, but I would assume that the flow rates are really small.
Okay, and then as a follow-up, the terrain that you're working on there is mostly colluvium and coarser-grained soils along the sides of the valleys and down in the valleys. Is that correct?
No. It's clay.
Oh, it's clay.
It is the sand. If you look at that picture... that field where I've just, where you see all the windrows, the upper third is sandy, and then the lower two-thirds is silty clay. In fact, the top it's the Prairie du Chien, as far as I know, on top. You have you have rock, and then you have really soft sand, and then below that, so the sand goes down a little bit on that field, and then there's a clay, very rich, heavy clay.
Okay, and so you're going to have your little drain lines go down on top of the clay? Is that your...
Just below.
Just below.
Just in it. I mean, just a little bit below.
Okay.
So the idea is to avoid problems is that I have to fill the drains first, before there's a big rush of water going in, so that they're pretty much always full. Okay. So the idea is that the pond will keep them full, and the flow rates, of course, will be really small. Because you don't, and I can space them very closely. So they're really small ones, spaced, maybe this far apart or that far.
So I was just wondering, you aren't worried about if you have a lot of rain of actually flooding your fields further down?
The fields are, no, it's certainly not, the fields are never flooding. What happens is you get, it collects in the valleys, so it's all grass, so there's no erosion. It collects in the valleys, and in the middle of the valley, you get erosion. So you can see
But if you stop it with the pond, then there is no problem in the fields eroding or large quantities. It's pretty gentle.
Okay. Thank you.
So you've never had that problem. But those are, yeah, they're good points, and that's why I want to try it out in the field, and so that when I propose it, you know, I can say, because if I propose it to NSF, for example, they will say, well, how did we know it works? I say, well, I actually did it.
Oh, thanks, Lanya. Over here, I may have this wrong, but it seems like when we're dealing with water on the landscape, water on the landscape end and the groundwater, it's kind of a zero-sum game. And so the challenge, it seems like in the two examples you have with your farm and then the coastal situation, is that, you know, we're sort of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and it's a matter of maybe of degree. But when we take the water in your farm, we're also have to acknowledge that we're removing it from the natural ebbs and flows that might be needed in certain creeks or streams for those habitats. We move the water down. We might decrease the recharge because now we're increasing our evapotranspiration by the kind of plant material that we're supplying with that water. I don't know if that's the case, but we're moving water around the landscape. It's not being manufactured, or we're not adding more water, we're just taking it from someplace else. I don't know about the case in saltwater intrusion. It seems to me if we would increase the flow in a low unit like that, it would change the heads someplace else. The water's got to come from someplace else. Now, here's the thing. I'm not sure if it would increase or decrease the heads further up gradient, say, in that kind of a situation. But to increase the flow at a lower unit to drive or to keep the salt water out, it seems like it's taking it from somewhere.
It's redistribution. So the comparisons I showed are the same transmissivity. So what happens is because the lower layer is more permeable relative to the upper one, most of the flow, the total flow is not affected that much, but the lower one is carrying more of the water. And what happens is that it raises, you can prove mathematically that the head at the coast goes up. Not the head, the value of the potential that controls the flow rate goes up along the coast. And in fact, in that example I gave, it goes up by 30% if you redistribute the hydraulic conductivity. And that just means so the head goes up here, right? So you get less flow. If you keep the head the same here, the flow is less. If you keep the head the same there, the head goes up there rather than down. And with the farm, this is actually, I don't agree with you, because what is happening, what I've noticed at my farm, but that is maybe different elsewhere, but the intensity of the rainstorms has dramatically increased. So I'm losing, I have ditches that I've never had before. And so what I'm doing is, instead of losing them, because the water would, in the past, would have infiltrated, right? It's slower, a more gentle rainstorm will infiltrate. Right now, instead of infiltrating, it shoots down. And actually, where we are, there's a creek called Bear Creek. It's maybe 4 or 5 miles to the Mississippi River. This goes straight into the Mississippi. So instead of seeding it, putting it in the Gulf of Mexico, we are essentially doing what it used to be. We had a lot more. I know that from the farmer who farmed this land this has been farmed for over 100 years. They never had to even think about irrigation. The natural conditions are on the hills, it's sandy, so the rain falls on the forest, and it drips down, the trees use what they need, and the rest goes into the sand, and then it flows downhill, and it goes against the clay. So it's naturally really very, very good system. And only in recent years, because of these incredibly high volumes of rain that doesn't get a chance to go into the soil, we have this problem. So in my view, I'm just restoring the situation. But you have a good point. I mean, and every case is different, so we have to look at every case individually.
Where is your property at?
Good. Do you know Lake Pepin? You know where Lake Pepin is?
Yes.
It is on the Wisconsin side. It's near the township. The town is Durand.
Sure.
You know where? So it's right in between Durand and Mondovi.
Very good.
Halfway in between. Beautiful.